This is a previously recorded episode. This show is broadcasting live from Detroit Sound Studios above Activate Gaming and is part of the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
To the Nooner Show. I'm Jay Dubs.
And I'm Denise Brennan Nelson.
And we are part of PodcastDetroit.com network, broadcasting live from the Detroit Sound Studios above Active 8 Gaming in Ferndale, Michigan. Woo-hoo! Happy hump day, everyone.
Yeah, it's Wednesday.
It is Wednesday. Okay.
Glad to be here.
I know. Me too.
And we've got some great guests in the studio today. Actually, I don't know if they're great. They're a couple of characters. We have with us live here today, we have Vincent Brennan, a.k.a. Uncle Vince.
Uncle Vince.
Uncle Vince. That's what I'm going by. And alongside him is his better-looking, wiser, and older brother, John Brennan.
What a suck-up you are, huh?
Thank you.
Yes.
Wow.
Well, he's buying lunch today, so I figured
I'd throw that in there.
And because it's my dad, I'll just put that right out there.
Sure.
My dad and his brother, actually, Uncle Vince, you are cute.
It'll give you 3 hours to stop that.
Over the years I've heard them go back and forth about, you know, who's wiser, who's better looking, you know, who's looks older and younger and all that. And there's a pretty big age span between. So we know who looks younger, right, Uncle Vince?
Yeah. Thank you again.
You're going to end up walking home, Denise. You know, I would just kind of stop right now if I were you.
I drove.
Oh, you did. Oh, good.
Do I look like I was born yesterday? Rachel, my daughter would say, not with those wrinkles.
Jeez. Don't you love kids?
Oh, yeah, you got to love them. Got to love them. They keep us on our toes. So, yeah, we'll be getting with them a little bit later.
I know. I can't wait. Because I've already heard a little bit, snippets of these stories. So this is going to be very interesting and inspiring.
Yeah. Uncle Vince is going to share his time in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So. Great stories.
How's your summer bucket list going?
My summer bucket list is going great.
Is it really?
Well, I had a pretty lofty summer bucket list.
That's right. This is only your second week here. That's right. I had to do this by myself for four weeks.
Stop it. I don't have my army boots on for all the crap you throw at me.
Oh, jeez.
No, I am a little bit sad. It's 2 weeks till Labor Day.
I know. Well, and with the weather yesterday, I'm thinking, I don't know how many days are left, but it felt like October yesterday. It was cold.
I know. But it's going to get warmer.
I know.
And
that's true.
September and October are still beautiful months. Actually, November is a beautiful month in Michigan.
Well, that's because it's your birthday.
That's true.
Right.
Oh, don't you think I won't remind you of that?
I have it written down.
Prior to.
I have it written down everywhere.
Oh, wait. We didn't miss your birthday, did we?
See, look at you. Are you serious?
September 16th.
There you go.
Whew.
Okay.
You're going to remind me, right?
Absolutely.
Okay,
you'll get a text every day. Now, listen, my Facebook page, though, said it was my birthday like 2 weeks ago or something like that, because I don't know how to use Facebook, so I have no idea where that date came from. But all these people, very nice people, were wishing me a happy birthday.
Including me. I called you up. I was freaking out. I'm like,
is it your birthday?
Yeah.
Do I have to go out and get you something?
Did I miss your birthday? Mm. And I'm sure these two gentlemen in our studio have never missed a birthday, right?
Nope.
No.
Nope.
Like Aunt Marilyn's birthday, you never miss?
With the help of my mother-in-law, yes, she used to remind me twice preceding her birthdays and our wedding anniversary. She was so wonderful. She'd call me up 2 weeks in advance and then call me the day before to double reminders.
That is a good mother-in-law.
Yes,
and I know my dad's great with birthdays, so we won't even go there.
So what happened to you then?
Well, your birthday's not here yet. September 16th. September 16th. I've got it in my head. I'm pretty good.
Okay, good. Okay, so I know that you heard about that Before I Die Wall.
I have heard about it, thanks to you. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about it, Uncle Vince?
I have, and I really am not familiar with the details, but I have, but I can't remember now.
Okay.
Sorry.
So Jessica, have you? By the way, Jessica's here in the studio with us.
Thank God.
Yeah, she runs our mics and our, you know, she makes sure everything's working. So thank you, Jessica. Have you heard of the Before I Die boards?
No, I have not. So I know you had mentioned that earlier, and I was waiting because I was really curious.
Well, and again, Jackie pointed this out to me, considering that there are like over 1,000 of these walls in 70 countries in 35 languages, I was surprised that I hadn't heard of it.
Right.
So thank you, Jackie. And it is. It's a global public art project that invites people to reflect on their lives and share their personal aspirations mm-hmm. in public space. Yeah. And they're everywhere.
Did you hear about how it started?
Refresh my memory.
Okay, it was an artist out of New Orleans. Her name is Candy Chang. And I watched her on TED Talks. Did you get a chance to see that?
See that?
You have to watch it. It's so good. And it reminded me of last week's show when we had Julie Rabini on, who lost her daughter at a very young age, and Julie and her family started the foundation Claire's Day. And we were talking about, is there an upside to tragedy? And that's exactly what happened in this situation. Candy went through a terrible loss, was very depressed. Mm-hmm. She's an artist, and her way to channel her depression was to create this wall. She wanted to, so she got a hold of somebody who owned this abandoned house that was right in her neighborhood and asked if she could do this, and they gave her permission to do it. Now, this was like 4 years ago, and she just wrote the same sentence, before I die, I want all on the wall. By the next day, she said that the wall was filled.
With chalk. They used chalk so that it can be erased and
right.
know, it's go online and check out some of the things that people write.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did. And one of them was, I thought of myself here, one of them was, I want to eat everything before I die. So I checked that off my list, and I thought, I already did that. I mean, there are a lot of really funny things on that. But anyway, on her TED Talks, she said, preparing for death is the most empowering thing you can do in your life. It adds clarity on what your purpose is. You have to watch this. It's
was the TED Talk?
Yeah, that was the TED Talk. And it reminded me, a couple weeks ago, I met a friend of a friend. And this lady is probably early 40s, late 30s. And I just heard her story. I met her 2 weeks ago, and she just found out that she has 6 months to live. I mean, she has been fighting brain cancer for a long time and was told she had 6 months to live. And after hearing that, I couldn't get it out of my head because I kept thinking to myself, well, what do you do when you're told you have 6 months to live?
Right. How, yeah. How
like, would you want to know that, do you think?
Ooh, boy, that's a tough question. I don't think, unless I was in that position, I don't think I can answer that.
Right.
My first thought is no. I would just as soon go out. And on the other hand, you know, does it give you some clarity? Does it give you time to say goodbye and prepare a little bit? And
right.
Die with dignity and grace? I don't know. Would you? Would you want to know?
I don't know, because part of me thinks, how do you not stop living and then just wait to die if you know you're going to die? You know, I don't know. But then again, you could tie up a lot of loose ends. You could plan. Like, I think I'd want to plan my funeral.
I've already done that.
You have? How come I wasn't included? Don't you want me to sing?
You're giving my eulogy. What are you talking
about? Oh, God. You don't want me to do that.
But I wrote it. It's okay.
Oh, yeah, okay. I figure, is it going to be a rhyme?
No, it's not a rhyme. No, but I'm joking. We shouldn't joke about such a heavy subject. But you know what? On the other hand, we're all going to die.
Right.
I mean, we're not...
Exactly.
Nobody's getting out of
right.
that. So,
right.
But I do like the idea that people are sharing. I mean, some of the interesting ones that I saw on the board, somebody wrote, get my wife back.
Oh.
Somebody else wrote, do it all over.
Really?
Somebody else, tell my mother I love her. Find my mythical creature.
Wow.
See the elite fall. Feed an elephant. Hike the Appalachian Trail. I mean, there's just, it runs the gambit, you
right.
know, from really thought-provoking or profound to just some really simple things. And,
right.
you know, I don't know about you, but I started thinking about, before I die, what do I want to do? I mean, I'm assuming Uncle Vince and Dad, are you thinking right now? Because we're going to pose this question to you. So while we share ours, you might want to think, I know what one of my dads says. We'll talk about that in a minute.
So what's yours?
Oh, we just pointed at each other like, you go first. You go first.
You know what? I was thinking about it too. And since somebody else already wrote on there, I eat everything. Right. And I've already done that. I think it would have to be to see my kids fulfill their dreams. I mean, I would love to see that before I die.
That's a good one. Oh, now mine sounds terrible.
Really? What is yours? It's probably what? You want to skydive?
Well, first of all, we got to go back to the eat everything, because I did see that and I thought, oh, that's what I want to do. But mine was eat everything and not feel guilty.
Is that yours?
I eat everything all the time, but I don't want to feel guilty. No, mine is learn to pack light.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Before I die. And if my husband's listening to this right now, and he better be. But my kids, they're laughing because it's a disease that I have, and my dad knows that as well. It's pretty hard for me to pack light. No, and that is on the lighter side of things. Mm-hmm. But I did think, boy, wouldn't it be nice? And to take it one step further is to live simpler.
Mm-hmm.
Without so much,
right?
So much baggage, literally, figuratively, all that.
Right.
You know, just to kind of live with less. So that's it on a deeper meaning.
I wonder when people write on the board if, like, for example, the more thought provoking things, if they really mean it. Like, if things change after, you know, they're aware of it after they admit it and they write it.
Well, remember what Julie Rubini said last week, and we both agreed that when you take pen or pencil to paper and you write things down, whether it's goals or dreams or whatever, aspirations, things that you want to do, it gives it purpose. I mean, that's why I'm such a big believer in journaling.
Right.
That it makes it more concrete.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, you know, I would think, I saw a woman interviewed, I think it must have been, and she was talking about her wanting to see her grandkids.
Oh, wow.
You know, so hopefully if someone else saw it and...
You know what? We should go down there. It's on Woodward in Detroit. We should go right on there.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
All right. So, Uncle Vince, before I die, I want to... I told you to be thinking about it. What, were you sleeping? Hello.
I have been. And what Jackie mentioned about seeing your children flourish and accomplish their goals.
Right.
So that's wonderful and well put. And I think I have to jump on board with that one.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
You don't want to learn to pack light?
Or eat everything.
Right. Well, I already do both of those. So.
You do not. No, you don't. Okay, Dad, I know what you want to do, but let's see what was in your head.
Well, I would affirm what Jackie said. In addition to that, I guess if I could see perfect peace, and while I see it, enjoy a six-pack of...
Nooner beer.
Nooner beer.
Beer, yeah.
There's such a beer. You'd like it as well. I thought you were going to say, because he has mentioned this the last couple summers, I want to go perch fishing one more time before I die. Oh, you guys just want to have loftier goals and make me look bad. And you know what? You can't copy off of Jackie anyways.
And I don't...
Anyway.
And I don't appreciate you rolling your eyes like that.
Oh, they were just sucking up to you.
I'm kidding. Oh, yeah, right.
You're not going home with her, by the way. Your ride's with me, people. All right. So, Jessica, you think you're getting off the hook here, don't you?
I was thinking that way, yeah.
What? Before I die, what do you want to do? You don't have kids, so.
No, yeah, okay, I was good. Just going to say, well, I don't have kids, so it's not to see their dreams come true yet. You know, if I did, then I guess that would be it, but. I don't know. I guess to make a change in some way.
Probably a different radio station. It's okay. Sorry.
No,
we won't look for your comment on the board. Don't worry about it.
You could have said something like, see these two, you know, I'm just
grow kidding. With the Nooner Show.
Right.
I
become their executive
flourish.
Vice president.
There you go. We already have a CEO.
That would be awesome.
We do have a CEO.
Becca.
Well, you could be executive
vice president. That would be my second wish.
Oh, hey, you know what? We love giving out titles.
Yes,
I
we
like
do.
Titles.
We don't like to pay
titles.
Anybody.
Yeah, we don't pay anybody. But we do give out titles.
We're too cheap to pay anybody. Well, we should move on to the best part of the show.
Absolutely.
So we have with us, as I mentioned earlier, Vincent Brennan. And as much as I would love to talk to you about real estate, as you know, Jackie, he's extremely successful in the real estate business.
I know.
Your travels, Uncle Vince has been traveling, how many years now? Five? You've been doing some amazing trips?
Yeah, six, seven, I think it's been something like that.
Okay. So we're going to have him
back.
We're
going to have him back for that. But what we really wanted to focus on, and I should just give an itty-bitty background to this. When Jackie and I first decided we wanted to do this radio show, we made a list of potential guests, people that we thought that had topics and stories that were were really fascinating.
Right.
And Uncle Vince was in the top
five.
Mm-hmm. Maybe the top three. And that's because I've been fortunate enough over the years to listen to the stories that Uncle Vince has shared with us.
Right.
And, you know, the thing that you and I agree on, Jackie, is that, you know, this isn't political. This isn't... It isn't about facts and statistics and, you know, who wanted to do this. It's about bringing the human element to something that's really important. And, I'll be honest. It was so far away and it was a long time ago, and it's easy to say, I wasn't even born when it started. And
right.
I was young when it ended. But,
right.
When you start,
it's easy to be removed and to really not get involved or understand it. And especially if you don't have anybody, you know, really close. I mean, it would be different. Think about it. If our husbands or our sons or daughters were serving, you know, we would obviously
be more involved.
Exactly.
Emotionally and all of that. But I just, like I said, I've listened to Uncle Vince tell some stories, and he's a great storyteller, and so we have him here to share some of those stories. So,
On that note,
why don't we go ahead, Uncle Vince, and just sort of, you know, lead our listeners into, you were an aerial gunner.
Initially, I was what's called a surface-to-air missileman. So I was trained in surface-to-air missiles.
Okay. How old were you when you enlisted?
17.
Okay. So 17 years old, you go off to war. Tell everybody, you know, just kind of paint that those first few weeks, months, if you will.
Well, can I ask you, at 17, what were you thinking?
Not much.
Okay. I mean, did you have like a pre-notion on what you were getting into, or?
Absolutely not.
Not at all. Okay.
I mean, so. I certainly had what I envisioned.
Okay.
You know, a little boy. I was a very immature 17-year-old devout.
Okay.
So, what I envisioned was a lot of fun and being like what was in the movies.
Oh.
Those old movies from the 40s and 50s and early 60s, you know, going off being a war hero and everybody having fun. And,
wow.
You know, I
how quick did that change?
Oh, after about a half hour.
About a half hour.
Oh. Wow.
Well, actually, when I took my physical, I began to get an idea of just maybe this isn't exactly what I had in mind. But by that time, we had not been yet sworn in when I took the physical, but shortly after that, it began to get a little suspicious. And by the time I got off the bus at Fort Knox, those doors opened and those drill sergeants were standing out there. It's much different now than it was then, hollering mm-hmm. and screaming and cursing and using words that I'd never heard, four-letter words I'd never heard in my life.
Wow.
You know, and preparing us for what was about to come. Then it became clear that this isn't exactly what I had
what
in
you
mind.
Signed up for.
Yeah.
So keep going. Then what happened? So you went to Fort Knox. You mm-hmm. had boot camp or basic training.
Basic training, yes.
Okay. And then get us to the, you know, where you were in the, you know, as an aerial gunner.
Yeah, that's almost a year into it, see. So there was a lot. I actually went to Germany, too. My first permanent duty station was in Germany, but it was only there, whatever it was, 2 months or something.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was, as I mentioned, trained in surface-to-air missiles and was sent over there. And by this time, an old-timer. I went from Fort Knox to Fort Bliss, although I had a three-week or a four-week training period in White Sands, New Mexico. And I won't go into detail on that, but that was one of the most, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but interesting educational experiences of my life.
Life-changing?
To some extent, yes. It was called the LP, or Leadership Preparatory Class, and it was only for a month, and it was very specialized, and as to why they sent me there, who knows. But
Can I ask you, so was the training, was that like mental preparation? Is that the kind of training they did?
Well, this was rather, if I can describe it as a generic type of a training, this LPC class. So it was just young men who were going to be in the military that they presumably, mistaken in my class, in my case rather, thought that perhaps these people would be good leaders. So it was almost all classroom, but it was out in the middle of the desert in White Sands, New Mexico, and very, very interesting. There was a certain amount of mechanical stuff, if you will, but it was primarily educational stuff. And the trainers or the officers and the staff were all combat veterans, accomplished combat veterans from World War II, Korea and from Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
These men were exceedingly experienced men.
Wow.
And had been a very accomplished leaders. So what they had to say was very, very meaningful. Mm-hmm. And it was incredible. I had more education in that month than I had had in my entire life.
Oh, wow.
In terms of real life, if you will.
Right.
You know.
Wow.
So it was wonderful. But anyway, went to from there back to Fort Bliss, took boring training in surface-to-air missiles, sent over to Germany. And I was only there for a few months in Wielflicken, Germany. Most Germans don't even know where that is. It was on what then at that point was the 5K zone or the Iron Curtain as well. You've heard of the Iron Curtain. Up in the mountains, the scenery was fabulous and beautiful and so on. So we got a lot of funny stories about that. But in any case, after a while, it's fun to get out of there. We want to go to war, you know, myself and several of the other young bucks. We just want to go to war. The only way to do that was to volunteer to leave and go to Vietnam, not knowing exactly what we were going to do when we got there. Well, and the deal was, so they let us go. There were several of us, I don't know, three or four in the company who at the same time requested to go to Vietnam. The war was, Johnson was just upticking the number of combatants, and it was going up dramatically. They doubled it inside, I think, 1 year, if memory serves me correctly. So they were really wanting to get any soldiers they could over there. So the deal was you got, a 10-day vacation between tours. So I left Germany, went home for 10 days, lots of fun, and then went to Fort Lewis, Washington, a few days, change uniforms and get extreme warm weather gear from extreme cold weather gear, and a certain amount of training as to Vietnam, what to expect and what not to expect. Mm-hmm. And then a 24-hour flight from SeaTac Airport, whatever the air base is there. It doesn't make any difference. Outside of Fort Lewis. From there to Cameron Bay, Vietnam. And it was a 24-hour flight. We stopped in Yokota Air Base in Japan for very briefly and went on 24 hours on that plane to go to Vietnam. And then assigned from there to another surface-to-air missile outfit. And I would guess after 2 months, and that was outside of Long Bend, at Tanzanut Air Base. In any case, after a few months, the missile unit's going back. You get to either you can either go back with the unit, become a gunner, an aerial gunner, or become an infantryman, grunt, as we call them. Well, we knew being an infantryman was no fun, you know, out in the ville, you know, the ville meaning the filth and the, junk and jungle and getting shot at and so on and so forth. So flying around in a helicopter, that'd be lots of fun. Let's do that, 18-year-old kid. I was 18 by this time. But in any case, so from there then is when it was after that point. So at this point, I'd been in about roughly a year or something.
Okay.
A little less than a year, I guess.
So of the three you chose, you thought, okay, I'm going to fly around in a helicopter. You have this sort of glorified...
Silly notion.
Silly notion. That's a better way of putting it. Okay, so then what?
Well, you had asked earlier about training, becoming an aerial gunner. And I said, about 15 minutes.
Wow.
At that time, there was no specific MOS for an aerial gunner.
Tell them what an MOS is.
MOS is an acronym, military. They still use it, I believe, military occupational specialty. In other words, what your job is in the military. And they assign 16D10, whatever it might be. They assign this code, if you will, for everybody in the military. This is your MOS. But you can have primary and secondary MOS. So my primary would have been surface-to-air missileman. Secondary was aerial gunner. They had no number to it because it was a new position.
And the training was 15 minutes.
Well, I'm exaggerating.
I know.
But I think I had my first three missions.
So a half hour.
Yeah. We double that, yeah.
It's kind of like our training.
Right?
Yeah. The first three missions, there was a preliminary. I'd never been on a helicopter in my life.
Wow.
I said, okay, this is a helicopter. And you walk around, show you a few things. And this is your weapon, and here's where you mount it, here's your ammunition. And the first three missions, there was another gunner. And I think there were two separate gunners, but in any case, we went out on runs that were referred to frequently as milk runs. They were easy missions, So the first three were with another gunner who had some experience under his belt and was trained, not to mention the other air crew, the other gunner, the pilots, and the flight engineer.
There were typically five on a helicopter.
In Vietnam, yeah. There'd be an air crew of five. There'd be an aircraft commander, co-pilot, a right gunner, left gunner, and a flight engineer.
Okay.
And flight engineer was the man who ran the aircraft as a practice. Didn't fly it, but he he knew that aircraft one side to the other, inside out.
So know. Even though there was a pilot and a commander,
aircraft commander,
the aircraft ACP. Commander, it, you're saying the engineer is basically the person that ran the helicopter.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was the one that everybody looked to with regards to that aircraft.
Okay.
And he knew it. He was on that aircraft. It was his aircraft as a practical matter.
Okay. So. All right, so go back to the story you were telling earlier. I want everybody to hear that story about, so you're signed up to be an aerial gunner. Talk about the commander and the field trip he took you on.
Well, this was before we were officially signed up to become aerial gunners.
Okay.
This is when the unit was going back, and forgive my memory lapse here. There's some of it, in the interest of time, I'll try to cut it off as best I can, too. But in any case, the surface-to-air missile unit was going back. They were going to take it back. They didn't need it there, so they were going to send it back to the States. So the option was to go back with the unit, become an aerial gunner, or an infantryman. So, and with regards to aerial gunner, there were size and weight requirements, and you had to be a good shot, presumably, and this type of thing. So, in any case, the commanding or the sergeant came out and had those of us who qualified. Some had to go back. If they only had a few months left, they had no choice. They had to go back. I believe married soldiers had no choice. They had to go back with the unit, and then the rest of us who qualified otherwise to be an aerial gunner, an infantryman, and, well, one of those two, because those were the people who wanted to stay, those were your choices, had to have certain qualifications as well. So in any case, there were, I don't know, a dozen of us, something, 15, I don't know. They lined us up outside. The sergeant, and he came out and explained our options and said, okay, how many of you? And I think all but two or three wanted to be aerial gunners. So anyway, then this is where I'm great. I think it was later in the same day they had us out again because they were folding up the battery, the artillery. It was referred to as an artillery battery, even though there were missiles, surface-to-air missiles, getting ready to leave, if you will. And the commanding officer, but this was a little unorthodox for him to have us back out because the sergeant had done his job to be the master sergeant, I guess. And these guys there's 15, for example, 12 of them want to be gunners, the other three want to be grunts, infantrymen, so off they go, different units. Well, from what I gather, when I reflect back, the commanding officer thought better of it, and as we discussed earlier there. But in any case, he had another formation. We all were standing out there, and he came out, and he was a good guy. He was just he seemed like a gentle person. Didn't know him personally. It was certainly a divide between officers and enlisted men, but he seemed like a good guy. Anyway, not supposed to say anyway.
That's okay.
He said,
comes by naturally.
He said, so you guys, whatever. His words were very, very profound, not necessarily then, but now. 12, you guys want to be heroes. He said, and he went down the line, and he pointed like to every second or third man, you're going to get killed, you're going to get killed, you're going to get killed.
Wow.
You're going to get maimed, you're going to lose your arms, you're going to be blind, or whatever he said, you know. And, we were repulsed, of course, a bunch of young kids, you know. He said, you still want to go. And everybody did, other than the two or three are going to be infantrymen. They would be more at risk. But in any case, then he loaded us on a truck. He had a deuce and a half there. Some of the soldiers listening can relate. You get on this big, gigantic truck. And we didn't know where we were going. He says, you're going for a ride. So he got in the cab, if you will, with the driver and the we're all in the back as a bunch of young bucks, we're carrying on, hooting and hollering and teasing one another and ranting, you know, just lots of fun, a bunch of young kids, you know. So off we go, and it was, I don't know, an hour drive, wherever we went. We had no idea where we were going. And it was Gray's registration. It's very sad and not morbid, but very, very sad. In any case, as soon as we turned in, what are we doing here? And there was a gigantic hangar, what used to be a hangar at the end of the airbase. And it was Gray's registration, where soldiers who were killed in action were processed there. Their bodies were prepared for return to the United States. So they opened the doors. We walked in, and it's like it was yesterday. And they opened the doors, and as far as you could see on either side of this gigantic hangar, and I don't know how long that would be, several hundred feet, I suppose, long, and probably five stories high, but it was all open. And it had been modified. And there were slabs, as far as the eye could see, soldiers on every single one of them. There would be several hundred of them in there, I suppose. And they were nude, on their backs, dead. And, it was very morbid. But in any case, they had tags on their toes, and they had their name, rank, serial number. and also their MOS, or what it was I did. And he went down, and he was raising his voice, and he said, air crewman, air crewman, infantryman, air crewman, air crewman. And his point was, he said, this is going to be you guys next week. And
wow.
A whole group of us, three or four of you are going to be laying on these slabs.
Wow. You know?
And it was, anyway, it went on a little bit more than that. But to summarize, we got on the truck and going back, total silence going back. It worked.
Right.
Well, when I say it worked, not one changed their mind. Although there was some hesitation. Even yours truly, maybe not.
Wow.
And he was doing it. He didn't want you to be killed.
He was cursing at us after we got off the truck and got in front of him. And now he said, how many of you guys still want to be heroes? Words to that effect. And still not a sound, and everybody was white as a sheet. And there was the one man, young fellow, he was a kid, you know, and he was throwing up, and he couldn't make it through. He staggered out and was throwing up and was repulsed. He went back. They wouldn't let him after that.
But the rest of you
still
stayed. And you could have walked away at that point from being an aerial gunner.
Yeah, this was the moment of decision. I think we had an hour after that. After he dismissed us, we had like an hour.
Did you have conversation with the other
very
guys?
That's a good question, but very little. It was stone silence.
Wow.
Didn't even look at one.
Would he have gotten into trouble if his superiors knew that he did that, or is that was that?
Well, he was doing his job to some extent by doing. They were going back, and he would have been given instructions, presumably at the higher level, which would have been the battalion. Some of the officers listening to this can perhaps relate and would be better equipped to respond to that. But I can only assume that. He certainly had gotten his orders. Okay, here's what you've got to do with this group of people who are going to have to or should be staying in Vienna. Now they have still time left on their tour. So here's what we want you to do. Just do exactly what that sergeant had done earlier. You can be an aerial gunner, an infantryman, or you can go back with the unit. What do you want? Okay, job's done and over with. Now the next part where a couple hours later where the commanding officer came out and read us the riot act, now that is... Getting back to your question, I don't know, presumably, if that would have gotten back to the battalion commander, that guy, that commanding officer, and his name escapes me. I remember my last command, Major Kaiser at the helicopter unit, but he was a captain or a major, and he was an old-timer of 32 or something, you know, old to us. He was an old guy to us.
Young guy.
Yeah. Anyway, so to answer your question, he probably could have gotten some very serious. They probably could. I don't think they could have court-martialed. They probably could have. They probably would have relieved him if the battalion commander.
Because they had to have people in those positions. So why? I wonder why he did that.
I mean, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but he probably at that point maybe had mixed feelings about the war. And you know, if he's 32 and he's got these 18-year-old kids, I mean, or maybe that was just part of his job, that they wanted to make sure that they could stand up to, that, you know, they weren't too squeamish, that mm-hmm. the job you were going to do was really difficult. I guess we don't know.
Part of that, you're right about determining our ability to
tolerate that job.
Yeah, and most human beings aren't going to be able to do it the way they think they're going to. And that young man, for example, who became violently ill, that's a good point. Maybe that's one of the reasons, among others, he did it was pragmatic, if that's a correct way to, you know, for practical reasons. But it was abundantly clear he was borderline pacifist. You know, and when I reflect back, he was a hero. He was trying to do the right thing. He was trying to save these guys' lives.
Wow.
You know. And there were other volunteers.
It was a really risky job. I think I read somewhere that the mortality rate for an aerial gunner was like 75 to 78%.
Wow.
Yes, but that was just about that time. Right about that time, from my research and my experiences, it had changed dramatically. The military had gone to great lengths then, at least from my experiences and from what I've researched and other people I've spoken with. The military at that point, just some months before, had gone to a great deal of effort to learn from experience and, for example, put armor plating on some of the aircraft. Our aircraft at Ford Motor Company built the armor plating that was around the engines and other areas, and we had these vests that were clunky, but we wore them nonetheless, occasionally depending on the circumstances. And
so the mortality rate probably went down.
Yes, that's exactly right. You know,
that's good to know.
The weapon was much more sophisticated. It was designed specifically for an aircraft before they had a field weapon that these poor guys had sit in the side of the aircraft. And anyway, so technically they improved things. So the mortality rate went down considerably, is my understanding. It was still relatively high, but it improved dramatically right about the time that I went in.
So you're taken to this place, you know, you're shown a lot of dead bodies, you're told by a commander that, you know, half or better are going to die from this. You decide to go forward anyways and become an aerial gunner. Do you remember the first, I don't even know what you call it.
Mission
that you went on without... Well,
An instructor?
Yes.
So to speak, it was just another gunner.
After that first half hour of training?
I do not. Nope. I don't remember the first mission. I remember a staggering amount of apprehension and anxiety.
Going out.
Yeah, I do remember that.
The helicopter, we posted a few on our Facebook page, photos that you took and some of your buddies. The helicopter... Describe the helicopter, because they're not these small helicopters that we see flying over checking out traffic. I mean, what did you call them?
Well, it's technical. They're still using them, but there's different models. There's a CH-47, and we typically – that's a Chinook, a CH-47 Chinook.
Flying semis, you called them.
That was another expression.
That's how big they were, right?
Yeah, they were, I think, 10 tons. They were gigantic things, two jet turbine engines. And I knew enough about the mechanical part to be dangerous. I was a gunner, the flight engineer. Roger Faddis is his name, might be listening. But in any case, he, for example, was a flight engineer. He would have known all the technical stuff. But anyway, there were two very, very powerful Boeing engines, typical of what you'd see on a jetliner. In any case, so it wasn't just a little helicopter. You could actually get two Jeeps in there if you really wanted to, an entire platoon of combatants. That would be 32 in a platoon, and they'd have their combat gear and so a lot of weight. And we could take a lot of – so whatever – I can't remember what the payload capacity was, but it was high. So it was a very, very powerful, very fast aircraft, very versatile aircraft. You could take the thing anywhere and do anything with it.
Did you ride on the same helicopter for always?
No.
It changed.
But frequently, most of the most memorable experiences are with fuselage number was 847. I think that was Rogers, if you're listening, Roger. I think that's right. 847 was the fuselage number of his aircraft.
So you had a crew. You had a favorite crew did most. And tell everybody what you did. I mean, what was your job daily?
Well, to help prepare pre-flight the aircraft. In my case, for example, the left gunner would get the guns didn't stay on the aircraft overnight. We try to be back at sunset for various reasons, but not always. In any case, we'd have to clean the guns. The left gunner, that was part of his job, was to disassemble to some extent and clean those. The weapons would be filthy. That's another thing. You'd go to the gun shack and clean the thing up. That was at the end of the day. But early in the morning, it was called a windy driver. Our call sign was Big Windy in our unit. So if somebody could call on us, it's a Big Windy 847 or Big Windy 17, whatever the tail number of the aircraft was. So a Big Windy driver is a guy in a Jeep and drove around to everybody's hooch and woke him up, depending on what you would call it, P time. P was a shortened version of APU. That's the time you started, the pilot would start the auxiliary power unit. So your P time is 6 o'clock in the morning. The Windy driver would be around at 5 o'clock or 4:30 running in and screaming and hollering, get up, you got a mission, get out. We knew the night before on the mission board. We knew what our mission was generally. But we knew roughly what time we had to get up. And he'd drive around, wake everybody up, the flight crews. So in my case, I'd get the weapons out of the gun shack or out of the wherever they were, carry them. And they were very, very heavy. These things weighed a ton. But in any case, and ammunition. Frequently, the ammunition would be there. But mount the guns. Some of the stuff's coming back. I totally forgot about. Mount the guns. Make sure the ammunition was there. Water, very important. Had water and something to eat, usually a couple of cases of sea rations or something. Just canned food and stuff. Help the pilot, to some extent, but the flight engineer would do most of the pre-flight of the aircraft to make sure there weren't errant screwdrivers lying here and there or cowling. Cowling's a cover over some of the mechanical parts. Make sure he would have, in most cases, have run the aircraft up just to make sure everything was going smoothly before we actually took off. And he would need some assistance putting oil or hydraulic fluid or whatever it might be. So gunners would be a step and fetch to go get stuff for them, or put oil in or go check this or check that. And then to clear the air, then, pilots, we'd take off, we'd this helicopter it could lift off, but we'd actually tax it just like an aircraft. It had wheels on. So we'd back out of the, run up the aircraft. Flight engineer would walk around the aircraft and make sure the blades, before they, that they were clear of everything. And then communicating just like we are now through a helmet and communicating with the pilots, and everybody could hear one another. And he would clear the aircraft for flight and tell the pilot to go ahead and P to start, and they'd turn on the auxiliary power unit to start the engines. And they would, big gigantic flames, in the front, because occasionally the gunner would switch. The gunner would go out and do that, you know, act, if you will, as the... The first time I was back down, I was hit by a flame. Holy smokes. Not supposed to stand by the flame.
Wow.
They'd shoot out.
So once you have the helicopter, I mean, how did you know, who gave you the orders of what you would go and do?
That would have been
in the helicopter.
In the aircraft.
Right.
Well, the co-pilot was also, he would be the navigator. So he, you know, in terms of telling,
like what the mission was, right. Or who described what you were going to do.
Who gave you the orders?
Right.
That would have come from battalion. The battalion would assign them the day before. So now that could get changed on a dime. It could change mid-flight sometimes.
But every day you had a different mission?
Yeah.
And how many hours a day would you be doing this mission?
Well, if the aircraft broke down, that would be, I shouldn't say a good thing, but I mean, if a reason to go back. But generally speaking, they'd be sun up to sundown. You know, they didn't like to have particularly hooks or CH-47s. They didn't like to have them in the air, if memory serves me correctly, in the dark. It was only in the event of what they called the tactical emergency, if memory serves me correctly, that they would allow for hooks or CH-47s to be airborne.
So give me an idea of what your orders would be. What would the mission be?
The most common thing was called insertions and extractions.
Say it again?
Insertion. And
okay.
Extraction.
Okay. And what is that?
Insertion would be typically we'd leave our base and go to whatever a combat unit, infantry, and pick up a platoon, sometimes not a whole platoon, but frequently a platoon of infantry, and then take them out to wherever they were being inserted. They would have been, what is the expression? They would have been briefed on the ground as to their mission that morning. A lot of times they had no idea where they were going, what they were going to do. They knew they had to have a clean weapon and ammunition, and that's it.
So you would take these other soldiers in, drop them, you know, down
take into... into the ville, we call it. You're going into the ville.
Okay.
So that would be an expression, presumably, that evolved. And there was other expressions as to take the base out into some a forward unit and insert them. And there were hot LZs and cold LZs, or colder. Or
hot LZ meant?
Look, you know, there's potential enemy. The odds are elevated that you'll be shot at.
When you were taking these soldiers in, were you being shot at all the time?
No, not all the time. No, very frequently there'd be nothing. You know, but the anxiety level was still there because you simply didn't know.
And you're dropping off soldiers that...
Are your friends, probably, or
no.
People you knew, or no?
Didn't very frequently, never laid eyes on them before.
Oh, really?
Because we were in a, for a multitude of other reasons, we weren't part of the same... The infantry were totally separate, for example, from air crews.
Okay.
We were in an aviation brigade, so the infantry would be totally separate. And furthermore, we were a support company. We'd fill in, presumably, where other aircraft had been assigned and were lost in some fashion, whatever. And we would fill in for other aircraft. So we'd fly from one end of the country to the other and go. We'd occasionally even fly Marines. But usually they'd be American military, sometimes Australian, sometimes very frequently Filipino and Korean, mm-hmm. You know, and language barriers.
Would you go back and pick them up?
Not the same ones. Now, what we would do, for example, on the insertion, the deal was to get in and out very, very quickly.
Like how quickly?
Instantly. Well, you
like
mean how much time?
A minute? Two?
Well, yeah. Now, if you didn't have an external load and you just had the – challenging my memory here. But if you just had infantry and it was a clean LZ and you –
No enemies around.
Well, not only in terms of enemy, but the topography, for example. And there was always a danger of if there was an LZ clear tree stumps, you could set down. And that was part of the gunner's functions, by the way, was to hang out from the end of the outside of the aircraft and make sure when you're coming down, because the pilots couldn't, all they could see was in front of them. They couldn't see necessarily what they were setting down on. You don't know if they might be setting down on a tree stump. You know, bad things can happen, you know. and the flight engineer is busy with other things. So the two gunners, part of the responsibility was to clear the aircraft, to clear in the left, clear in the right, to make sure it was clear to go down all the way. And you're very exposed hanging up there. And plus you got that, talk about apprehension and anxiety. Those poor infantrymen were anxious to get off that aircraft, you know. So they'd be standing up ready to go, and the flight engineer would have the ramp down, but we're still at 30 or 40 feet. And it set down and get out of there. They'd run off in a hurry.
Would anybody not want to get off the helicopter?
Sure, I'm sure none of them wanted.
Well, and what I was wondering is, what kind of conversation do you have?
None. You can't.
None. So
we can, the air crew, because we have inside of our flight helmets was exactly this, what we're wearing right now.
But you're not having any conversation with them before you're dropping them off.
With the air crew or the combatants?
Infantry.
The infantry.
The infantry. A little bit, but they'd have to holler to the top of their lungs. The racket on those things was absolutely incredible. You got those two huge engines just 30 feet away from you with no insulation.
Okay.
You know, the noise, not to mention the blades and the transmission.
Right.
Matter of fact, they made us use ballistic helmets after my first tour because people were having hearing problems.
I remember you sharing a story about dropping a group off or picking a group up and you know, flying away and getting the orders to return.
Yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Yes, that was, for whatever reason, that is riveting in my mind, that the young fella's face and the whole thing. And I was very, very cold at the time to it, but when I reflect back. In any case, it was fairly typical. It was an extraction. So we had very likely had done some type of an insertion or a load or something. We had to go over and extract. It would have been a platoon of soldiers who had been out there for a month, you know, and been through who knows all kinds of horrific, you know, horrible stuff, filth, living and sleeping in bogs and mud and filth and eating out of cans and eating gray water, you know, that they got out of a bog. Who knows? I mean, the filth is just staggering, and the heat, and you just can't, the horror. But in any case, so these guys get on, and they know they're going back. They've been out there for 30 days. They know they're going back. These guys are all fired up. They're going back to the rear and, you know, going to be able to get a shower and eat some real food and get drunk and have all kinds of fun, you know, for a few days or whatever period of time it was, 4 or 5 days typically is the time they'd have in the rear. Then they'd go back out. So they know they're going back to the rear. They're getting out of there. They're going to be relatively comfortable and safe for 4 or 5 days. So we picked them up and off we go. And it was a might want to call it cold LZ. There was no activity. So picked them up and we took off. And we're about halfway out. And you could hear the pilots talking. And what apparently had happened, there was another LZ someplace where bad stuff was happening. So that is guys being overrun or what have you. And they said, we're going back in, I think was what the aircraft commander said. And he suddenly just banked left really, really hard, making a U-turn is what it amounted to. This is about halfway back to the rear. And those guys picked up on it instantaneously. They went, and they could hear one another. They were screaming and hollering, but they're poking and jabbing again the way a bunch of young guys would, you know. And all of a sudden, everything, as soon as we banked, everything stopped, and they all looked up at us, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I looked over at them, and the looks on their faces, you know, and in any case, they knew something was up. So I said, the young man sitting closest to me is a radio man, getting back to just a little guy. What the radio men typically were little guys, just a little guy. He probably wasn't 110 pounds, and he had, back then, no technical stuff. Now, this was a gigantic 65-pound radio that these kids had to wear on their backs, with, by the way, a 10 or 12-foot antenna, with, by the way, a flag on the end, said, here I am.
Wow.
Wow. Have poor they improved
kid.
That, I'm hoping?
They what?
Have they improved that, I'm hoping?
Yeah. They got a little thing like this, like right. An iPhone.
Yeah, know? That's true.
In any case, so he grabbed my arm because he saw that picture. But in any case, he grabs my arm, you know, and I pulled the helmet away, and where are we going? And I said, you're going back in. And, you know, I didn't care. You know, it was just cold, you know, going back in. And he passed it to the next guy in the office. So I'm glancing at them because we're real high, probably at 4,000 feet or something. And these guys talk about heroes. To a man, I'm sure they were cursing up and down a storm, you know, screaming and hollering and whatever. But they immediately got their weapons out, you know, started to secure their backpacks, doing their job, doing what they're supposed to do. After sitting out in that, you know.
Oh,
wow.
That makes me want to cry.
They're cleaning their weapon, getting the ammunition ready. You know, doing the right thing. The platoon commander would have been a young second lieutenant. He got up and he's going down, checking, making sure they're already good to go, you know. And this kid, anyway, was feverishly. He got his radio doing his job. You know, no weapon. He's just got the radio, runs around, gets shot at or something. You know, poor kid. Anyway, so he's feverishly searching through his – he pulls this plastic bag, a little – like a sandwich bag, you know, pulls this plastic bag out. And he just hands it to him, and he points to it, you know. And there are letters. And because, you know, they're out in the ville. He apparently had a pen and some paper. And there were letters to his – I think his mother and his girlfriend. He and I just exchanged a few words. He had noise. He had to scream into. Would you mail these for me? And he said, yeah. And I shoved them in my pocket. You know. In any case, he, the kid, and he's looking up at me. I can't. I'll never forget his face. You know, not shaving. I mean, he didn't even have a whisker. You know, he looked to be about 12. You know, he may possibly not even have been 18. He may have been. A lot of them lied. A lot of those Southern kids lied. Not just Southern kids. You know, and somehow were able to. In any case, I don't know how old he was, but he was just this tiny, skinny little guy. And anyway, we went into the LZ and came down. And those guys, you know, part of the deal was to get off the aircraft as quickly as possible, not just for their sake, but for ours. You know, we want to get out of there. The longer we're hanging there, the more we're exposed. So the flight engineer would have had the ramp down. We're probably 20 or 30 feet off, and those guys are running, you know, right back into it. You know, unbelievable. And when we're lifting. Now, we were only down there on that insertion. I'll bet you we weren't in there a minute, you know, and pulled up and the ramp's coming up. And I see that, you know, they disappear into the jungle, into the village. And I see that.
The radio antenna or the flag.
Poor kid.
And you never, you know, you have no way of knowing.
No. No, we got to be, what is the expression? Hat up. Get out of here. You know, and the pilots would have. You know, they usually circle around to make sure that there was – see if there's anything else we could do, and then they just take out, you know, get out of there as quickly as possible.
Wow.
But when you're 18, 19 years old and you're doing that, you do. You just get sort of blinders on, don't you? And you just do your job. And, I mean, it's hard for us to believe.
Right.
I mean, I would stomp my feet and say, I'm not going.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Yeah, I've often thought that today someone pointed at that helicopter. Now, I want you to get on that 10-ton flying flying semi.
Yeah.
And do this. Are you crazy?
Right.
You would say that now.
Right.
Are you out of your mind?
Right.
But now, did you mail the letters?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were all covered with mud. And, you know, I remember going back, and I think I threw them on my bunk when I got back, you know. And fortunately, yes, I did, because I had to do – I think one of the letters wasn't even finished. He wasn't finished.
Oh,
it was still
wow.
out of the envelope. Because he managed to finish addressing the one envelope. But anyway, I left it laying on my bunk, I think, for a day or two or something. And finally, yes, because I remember cleaning the mud off it and complaining, I got mud all over this, you know.
Oh, jeez.
Poor kid. And it was one. I think there were two letters, one to the mother and one to the girlfriend, you know.
Wow, good for him for thinking about getting them out and having you send them.
Yeah.
Would you go back?
You mean now or then?
Would you go back? Do you ever think about going back and seeing what Vietnam looks like now?
No. Oh, do I think about it?
Well, would you go back?
No.
Now?
No.
No desire to see?
None.
Too many memories?
Yeah.
Do you have friends you've kept in touch with?
Some of them, yes. Yeah, not as many as I wish I would have. And I tried to track some down. Without success, but some, yeah, there's three or four.
What was it like when you were leaving, when your time was up? How did you feel?
Apprehension.
You
about
did?
Coming back?
Well, there's the last 10 days is there's an expression, ED, it's an acronym for exempt from duty. So the last 10 days, you're exempt from duty for a whole lot of reasons. There's things you have to do, but additionally, retrospectively, and talking to other people who, you know, you say, well, why would you do that? Why wouldn't they work them right till the very last day? A lot of the guys were trigger happy. They do things they shouldn't. They hadn't gotten their right rest. Were so fired up about going home that they kind of lost it. You know, so they just, let's just put them on the back burner and let them do whatever it is they need to do. They're not going to work for 10 days. So, I'm sorry. Your question, Jackie, then was?
I just was wondering, you know, when your time was up after you completed your
when you knew you were coming home.
Yeah, when you knew you were coming home. What was it emotional? Was it? Because I would imagine that, you know, being involved in something so intense and there's a certain bond, obviously, with some of the other crew members that most people would never understand.
No. Camaraderie is a gigantic, you know, my notes here, the camaraderie was incredible and wonderful.
I read that there's three questions a vet asks of another vet when they meet him. Where were you? When were you there? And who were you with? And that is in keeping with what you say. There's that camaraderie of how can we, no matter how many stories you would sit here and tell us, and it helps because I do get more of a feeling of what it was like, 12, 14-hour days. But we can't understand the fear, the apprehension,
right.
Or the
– right.
I mean, it's hard to explain. But the camaraderie, I think, is a part that we can understand.
Well, that's what I was asking. I mean, I wonder if – was there a part of sadness of leaving that
yes.
part of it? Because and what were you thinking when you came home? Like, did you know what you were going to do? What was life like when you left and came home?
Well, a little known fact that only veterans, for the most part, recall is there are civilians who have memories of it too. But there was apathy, and that's the understatement. Out and out bitterness I can't think of the appropriate words, but military at that point, we were referred to as baby killers by a staggering percentage of the population. It was really bad.
But can I just interject here? Because something that I've always remembered of the stories that you've told, I just want to say this before we run out of time, is that a lot of what you were doing, even with the helicopter, is though you were taking troops in, but you were also using the helicopter to get civilians on the helicopter and take them out of harm's way.
That was the
biggest part of your job, wasn't it?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up because I've been talking too much about myself. There's starters. There were 58,327 guys who are not able to convey their stories. But there were more. We did more shuttling innocent people around, children, families, old people, young people, infirmed, take them out of harm's way, to feed them, to take them food. You know, they came first.
Water,
whatever it took to help these people out. So if I had to bet of all those hours, all those missions, add up all the hours, at least half, if not much more than half, was humanitarian. Now they refer to it back then, that expression didn't exist, humanitarian aid. It was go out and the heroics that were involved. And when we always hear about people who get the Medal of Honor, there's not only in Vietnam War, but hundreds of thousands of men, and some women too for that matter, who are entitled to several Medals of Honor, but it wasn't witnessed, or it wasn't witnessed by the right people, they didn't get their medals. So the heroics that I had the privilege of watching and observing, these men, and not just a few of them, hundreds and hundreds of them, all across the board, you know, it was just wonderful to observe that. I was cold to it at the time, but boy, when I reflect back, I was exceedingly fortunate to witness the medics, for example.
Right, taking care of the injured.
Yeah, and it didn't make any difference, enemy or not. You know, if it was someone who needed help, the medics would take care of them.
Right.
Civilian, enemy, whatever.
Which is, again, and we're running out of time, unfortunately. Right. Time goes by far too fast, and we have just barely, you know, covered the tip of the iceberg,
right.
and put that, you know, put you there. I think that's what Uncle Vince has always done for us as a family, is put us there. And it's just too easy to forget what people
go over. Faith versus fear.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and to have that amount of courage, I can't even imagine.
I can't either.
I'm afraid of a mouse.
Yeah, I can't either.
So many of these kids, and they were indeed kids. They were just kids.
I saw pictures, Uncle Vince, and you know they're all over the table here. And even you look like you were young.
12. I mean, 12. Well, he was young. I mean, he was 17. 17. That's young.
Can you imagine?
No.
Not
at all.
That would be John Paul.
No.
Going on to war right now.
I was 18. You couldn't go into combat or something. And I was 18 after the end of basic training. But in any case, so I was 18, almost 19 by the time I got to Vietnam.
Well, I think what we should do is we do need to stop here because we'll run over. But I think we need to have Uncle Vince back. I think we need to have some of his friends across the country. We'll take some call-ins.
Absolutely.
Get some of their stories. Maybe get some questions. We're going to post some more things on Facebook.
Right.
I know we have a closing, something cool we want to end with.
Well, what was the last picture or memory
That you have.
Well, it was, and I wasn't the only one. There would have been thousands of others, and I, like, I feel bad about talking about myself so much. But in any case.
No, you're telling your story okay, right. as you saw it. You're not talking about yourself.
Right.
Yeah, and I certainly don't want to. But in any case, Cameron Bay is where I, that was when we took off from Vietnam. That was my last stop in Vietnam. So got off, they took us from the barracks, wherever we were, gotten there presumably a day or two before to process out. Got on the bus. They took us over to the terminal. When you say terminal, it's just a big, gigantic hangar. And we're standing in line, to get on the aircraft. And there was an old-type sergeant, a 32, whatever he was, old to me at the time. And we just want to get out of there. But he points up, and because it was silence, everybody just kind of waiting to get on the aircraft and get out of there. And he said, he was looking up at this sign, which was over the terminal, the path we had to walk on to get on the aircraft. And there was a sign up there, and I just glanced at it and didn't pay any attention, you know. But it said, and Jessica's more able to read this than I. It was a sign that everybody, you had to pass under this sign as you were exiting the country. This was your last experience in Vietnam, and this buck sergeant said, he saw my camera, and he said, take a picture of that boy. And I said, I don't want to bother. And he said, take a picture of it at some point and tell him you'll be glad you did. So I did. And that was the last thing
I saw. You listened to an elder? Yeah.
What did the sign say? Can you read it, Jessica?
Yeah, it said, through this aerial port pass more men who believe in freedom and human dignity than any other aerial port in the world.
Wow.
That was your last parting shot. I've been getting some messages from my siblings, Uncle Vince. Paula said, ask him when his favorite niece's birthday is. And she also said, good luck on packing lighter, Denise. Martin had quite a few questions here as well. This is a subject that I don't think we realize how fascinated people are.
Right.
And hearing the stories is a good thing. So I know you're getting emotional, Uncle Vince. You're going to make me cry, so don't do that.
Okay.
You need to come back because
yes.
there's a lot more stories.
Right.
And you know, I just think, again, that human element of it. It's
right.
It's not just about war. It's about, like you said, Jackie, faith and fear and courage and
perseverance
all of that. Perseverance.
And, absolutely.
You know, so many questions are still here on my board. How did it change you? And, oh, all sorts of things. But we'll have you back. This was episode one. We'll have
episode one. Thank
two,
you.
Three,
it was
four and five.
Oh, yeah, thank
very
you.
Good.
And yet, I think that's the quietest I've ever heard you.
Well, I was only going to ask Vincent to tell us the years he was in Vietnam, where he was based principally, and how many tours.
What were the years, Uncle Vince?
60. I forget the month I got over there. Anyway, it was 68. I was there 60, almost all of 68 and 69.
You had two tours. You signed up for a second tour.
Yeah, I came home between tours and went back.
And then where were you based primarily?
Long Binh, Thuy Hoa. Thuy Hoa was at the end, but the most memorable experience. So Long Binh, Cam Ranh, Thuy Hoa, and Chu Lai, which that was what I think they referred to that as temporary duty. But in any case, so those Thuy Hoa was the biggest one, though.
All right. Thanks, Dad.
Well, thank you for being here and sharing your stories.
Thank you.
We are going to wrap it up with a song that we think is appropriate for today's show, and it's performed by Eddie Money. It's called One More Soldier Coming Home, and it's actually was written by Greg Stryker, who is a local singer-songwriter. And so on that note, happy hump day, and thanks for tuning in.
Well, we'll hear you next Wednesday. Thanks, Jackie. Thanks, Uncle Vince. Thanks, Dad.
Thank you.
Thank all of you.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you. Great story.
This show is broadcasting live from Detroit Sound Studios above Activate Gaming and is part of the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. This is a previously recorded episode.